from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the news of the week, including the NFL's new national anthem policy and the ongoing turmoil at UMass Boston, which Boston Mayor Marty Walsh has offered to help fix.
It's not going to be solved overnight. It's not going to be solved by one conversation. But there has to be, people need to know their voice are being heard.
Also today, we listen in on some local commencement speeches.
You grew up with things like mandatory service hours as early as kindergarten onwards. You can and you will change the world as we know it today.
And with the kickoff to summer this holiday weekend, we ask how best to enjoy the season outdoors in New England.
The very compactness of our region means you don't always have to decide ocean or lakes, or ocean or mountains, beautiful towns or the wild, because within only a few days, or even in a single day, you can often experience all of that.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The continued tensions in the UMass system have dominated the news all this week, and this is how we're going to start the conversation with our Week in Review guest today. First, the turmoil at UMass Boston, where all three finalists for the chancellor's job abruptly withdrew from consideration. Now, that happened after public criticism from faculty members and a faculty statement that called all three candidates unqualified for the job. Sharon Lamb, Executive Committee member of the UMass Boston Faculty Council, told our show this week that the faculty feel ignored, especially after UMass President Marty Meehan bought Mount Ida College for UMass Amherst students.
The process was problematic from the beginning, and we really felt excluded. Mount Ida was just sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Faculty also voted no confidence in Marty Meehan. UMass Boston will now have its second interim chancellor for the time being. And Boston Mayor Marty Walsh weighed in on this week. He offered to help find a chancellor for UMass Boston. He said Wednesday he won't let UMass Boston go the way of Mount Ida.
We can't let that happen. I won't let that happen as the mayor, and I don't think the state reps can't let that happen. State Senate can't let that happen. Legislature, governor's office won't. It's an important resource in our city. It's an important resource for too many people.
And Governor Baker says he has concerns.
Look, I'm disappointed about the way this whole thing has played out. And as I've said before, the Mount Ida issue, I believe, is one that I'm glad the Attorney General is going to continue to investigate, because we need to know more about how that happened.
So, what's next for UMass? Joining us to talk about this and more news of the week is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston NAACP and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, how are you? Also with us, Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Hi, Ed.
Hello.
So, Michael, let's start with you. What do you think of what's been happening at UMass and the tension between UMass Boston and the Mount Ida thing and everything else?
Yeah, it's been confusing. I think first and foremost, congratulations to that graduating class over at UMass. I think they were graduating yesterday, and I got a chance to spend time at Fontbonne Academy with their graduating class, an amazing group of young women, maybe some of whom might even look at UMass as an option. It's disturbing. I think, one, I reacted when I heard the faculty call the candidates unqualified, because I know from a little bit I know of a few that they are qualified. So I challenged that. But then when I reached over to the campus and had a conversation with particularly faculty of color, I got the underlying message, which was, this is really about Marty Meehan. Mm. This was about a lack of confidence in him. I think it's a little bit of fallout from the Keith Motley situation with his removal from UMass. Folks are not happy, with the lack of transparency, the lack of communication.
And about the Mount Ida purchase, primarily.
Probably a combination of all of the above, the search process, the Mount Ida, and even the fallout from the Keith Motley situation. People don't feel included in the process, and whether that's a governance issue that they're challenging, it may be less about these three candidates and more about their impressions of his leadership.
Hmm. Ed, your thoughts?
I agree with all that. I also think that UMass Boston is feeling a lot of political factors at once. I think they're seeing the inequality in Boston and the city. I think they don't have the resources that they need. I think Dorchester is going through changes all around them. I think they're seeing a lot of higher education institutions struggle with their finances. So I think they have a morale crisis there, and they don't see that things are going to get better. So any crisis that comes up is going to hurt them, even if it's small. So I don't think it's really about any one of these things individually. I just think that UMass Boston is feeling insecure about the future. They feel like that they can't, you know, succeed in their mission, and they're looking for someone to blame.
Well, we heard the governor, Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, say that they would like to help. They want things to improve. The attorney general, of course, saying she wants more oversight of private colleges because of what's happening at Mount Ida. And she's weighed in about this, the whole Mount Ida purchase as well. So is it time for state officials and Boston officials to step in here and do something?
Yeah, I think it's too valuable of a resource. It's a training ground for many of the young people that will go on to serve our economy. I think there's no question. I think credit to the mayor, credit to the rest of our delegation and local elected officials who are willing and forceful about weighing in. I think it's necessary. I know when I talk to folks, too, this interim period, the interim leadership, not just at the top, but throughout the organization, throughout the campus, is really a concern for many. There's a lot of work to be done, and we need all hands on deck to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, but, you know, they say this, right? Everyone says they want to save the system. They want the system to be strong. It is our state public university system, after all. But the legislature never seems to fund it. Are people going to put the money where their mouths are? Ed, your thoughts?
I hope so, but you have to have a leader who puts it in those terms to say that if Boston is booming the way it is and we're pulling all this money and all this talent and so many people are doing well here and we have this organization that's supposed to be an institution or an engine of equality for students that really need it. Someone has to say that costs money. And maybe UMass Boston can reduce its expenses, but I don't see any way forward from UMass Boston's problems without more money from the state legislature.
Absolutely. I agree. Ultimately, we got to fund our priorities, and we have that challenge here in the Commonwealth.
Well, I've heard this for I don't know how many years, that the legislature needs to make this a priority. And what would have to happen to make it a priority, do you think, for lawmakers?
Well, I think ultimately there's the leadership. I don't know if there's been a general collection of elected business leaders coming together to call for some changes over, quite frankly, throughout the UMass system, but particularly UMass Boston. And then working with the legislature, you know, we have a very conscious leadership on both sides of the House and Senate. I think that there's a conversation to be had. And me just knowing the leaders that I've dealt with in both the House and the Senate, I think people would be receptive. But an argument needs to be made about cost efficiencies, about growing the system so that the college is competitive, because that's really the issue, is whether they can compete and draw in students from across the state and, quite frankly, across the country.
You know, we spoke with Latin American Studies professor at UMass, Reyes Coltayachaya, and she told WBUR that she'd like to see the relationship between UMass Boston and UMass President Marty Meehan improve. Let's listen.
The first thing we need to do is work with the new acting chancellor, see if she can help us repair the connection with the president's office, see if she is able to handle the budget the way it needs to be handled immediately.
Ed Lyons, Michael Curry, Ed, you first. I mean, is this it for Marty Meehan?
I wouldn't say that. He's not new to this. I just think that, you know, he's in a leadership vacuum right now, and is he going to step in and do that? I don't think he can do that by himself. I think someone else has to stand by his side and bring along either support in the legislature or some sort of a vision. So I think he'll be okay for a while, but I think that he needs to get some help soon.
Michael?
Yeah, you know, I've served on a community college that I will not name while I'm here, but they were going through similar challenges on the community college level. I've been a part of other institutions and called in to be a part of their teams during the transition. There's a clear message here that's going throughout the state, which if you're a stubborn leader that's not willing to change and adapt and fix those issues and be transparent and inclusive, you will probably not stay in that job. And I think that's what we're seeing across the state and, quite frankly, across the country.
What's the role of the Board of Trustees, though? I mean, does that help, you know, take some of that away from Marty Meehan?
Well, and the faculty that I talk to, they're implicated in this as well. The folks that I talk to on that campus are equally as frustrated with the Board of Trustees as they are with Marty Meehan.
Okay. Well, let's move on to federal courts here in Boston, because there were some really emotional hearings this week, and there will be another day of hearings next week. And these are about the authority of federal immigration agents. The hearings in Boston federal court have resulted in a promise from agents who say they will no longer arrest undocumented immigrants who are visiting government offices trying to gain legal status. Now, these hearings are being held by federal judge Mark Wolf, and he's been questioning ICE officials about their practices. cases. And during the days of hearings this past week, the judge has played a recording that's very emotional. It's a recording of Lucimar de Souza, who's a Brazilian immigrant who was separated from her children for 3 months after she was detained at a government office in Boston. And here's a clip of that recording of her emotional reunion with her 10-year-old son.
Vai!
So very emotional tape played during this hearing with Judge Wolf. I'm wondering, Edline, what do you make of these hearings in Boston this week?
You know, I think it's hard for us to accept that the great American consensus around illegal immigration is coming apart. I think that I grew up in near New York City, and, you know, it was sort of like, you know, if people are here illegally, but they kept their nose clean, and weren't stealing anybody's job, that we were just never going to get around to deporting them. It was sort of a way in which, you know, maybe if we got in trouble, things would come up. And we're really debating about, like, you know, how much trouble does someone get in before we deport them. And it's sad that something else is happening, something that's very alien, something that's happening at federal facilities in our own neighborhoods. And I think people just aren't used to the idea that, wait a second, there are things that are really against our values we've never seen, well, at least not in my lifetime, that are actually happening. We have to sort of accept this is happening and speak out about it.
There's actually an audit showing that some people were, you know, detained inappropriately. I guess it's probably the safest way to say it because there are so many people, but it's dozens of people who were detained inappropriately. I'm wondering, Michael, what do you make of these hearings and Judge Wolf doing this, and what do you think will happen from here?
Yeah, credit to Judge Wolf. And this is in the first thing when I heard of this story and this family's heart-wrenching story was I'm reminded that elections have consequences, right? And quite frankly, I serve on the Advocacy and Policy Committee for the National NAACP, and we often make the point that elections have consequences, and judges, the appointment of judges across the country have consequences. There is an anti-immigrant sentiment across this country right now that doesn't make sense. It's not something that's in the best interest of this country, and it doesn't protect us. It doesn't make us safer. And under this presidency, we'll see a lot more of this type of stuff happening. And thank God for judges that are able to check this sort of policy change.
But, you know, there are people who say, if you're here illegally, you can't be here. Breaking the law, right? I mean, there are maybe not so many in Massachusetts, but there are people who think that this is the way that things should be handled.
And it's just a reminder, I think, you know, I wish people knew American history more, right? Because I think we tend to forget, no matter what country you're coming from, that there are a lot of illegal immigrants that were here, that came here for a better opportunity. And go to any, there's a new name for the Office of New Bostonians, but go to any of those swearing-in ceremonies where people have been here, but then they went through the process, and now they're proud Americans who get to contribute. And the reality is there's millions of them that are waiting for the opportunity, and they're not violent, and they're not criminals. And the language right now is just disturbing.
Well, Ed, do you think that Massachusetts could face any repercussions for having these kinds of hearings, for a federal judge here having these kinds of hearings, from the feds or anything like that?
Yes. I don't think we can assume that the federal government is going to sort of let Boston be Boston or anything like that. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some sort of retribution or loss of funding. I think this administration is quite serious about inflicting its views on us, and we should be ready for that to happen.
Okay. Well, another contentious issue here, the debate about sports and the national anthem. So the new NFL policy this week requiring all players to stand during the national anthem, or if they don't want to stand, they can stay in the locker room, but they must be respectful. So NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell says this new policy allows the league to punish teams if their players do not act properly.
We want people to be respectful at the national anthem. We want people to stand. That's all personnel, and make sure that they treat this moment in a respectful fashion. That's something that we think we owe.
President Trump, who last fall said players should be fired if they refuse to stand during the national anthem, weighed in on the policy yesterday.
I don't think people should be staying in locker rooms, but still, I think it's good. You have to stand proudly for the national anthem. Well, you shouldn't be playing. You shouldn't be there. Maybe you shouldn't be in the country. You have to stand proudly for the national anthem.
Michael Curry, your take on the national anthem and standing or staying in the locker room during games.
Yeah, it's funny. Sometimes I hear Donald Trump think and speak. I tend to think of like Tiananmen Square or North Korea. I forget where I am sometimes because I think he doesn't realize that it's your choice to recognize the flag. And if you are, you know, I quite frankly, protections for people who aren't that American, but are Americans, who may not want to stand out of protest for the hypocrisy or the actions of police officers in government action who shoot particularly unarmed victims. I think he's missing the point here. And the point is, and it's now translating into the NFL ownership and the lost revenue, which is driving their decision in the NFL, that this is ultimately about people's rights. And the right, if I'm a football player in the NFL, you don't require me to stand. And I, quite frankly, I'm going to come out of the locker room and I'll pay that fine to stand on the field and not recognize the ceremony. So to me, this is just another Donald Trump cultural shift that's happening in the country.
Hmm. And Ed, what about you?
Well, it's been hard to watch this whole process the past few years that I think a majority of Americans disapprove of this. I think it's 86% of Republicans. So I have many, many friends that are on Facebook and Twitter saying that they think this is wrong. They support the new policy. And, you know, these are the people that tell me how great Dr. King was on his birthday every year. And what I tell them is that, you know, polling in the 1960s shows that about the same percentage, about 60% of people thought that the Freedom Riders were wrong, that Dr. King's actions were wrong, the lunch counters, sit-ins were all wrong, telling them, you know, we think this is going to hurt your cause. You're just doing it wrong. You know, so I want to say to all these people I know who, you know, are against the kneeling and all that, I want to say, if you've ever wondered who were those white people who opposed Dr. King and what he was doing, they said he was doing it wrong, you know, who discounted the underlying racism. I say, like, it's you. You are the white person who opposed Dr. King. And I know that's got to be really hard for you to hear. And maybe you should think about that before you celebrate his birthday again next year.
And just to add to that, who are those white people and who are some of those people of color who also opposed Dr. King? Because I think, you know, my favorite phrase, it takes time for truth to catch up to history.
Right.
There'll become a time 10 years, 15 years from now, we'll look back on this and we'll know who was wrong in this debate.
Mm. Well, you know, and the players apparently are divided as well. And we had a debate on this in the show yesterday. So we have a statement from former Patriots player Chris Long, who's now with the Eagles on Twitter. He said, all this is, this policy, is fear of a diminished bottom line. It's also fear of a president turning his base against a corporation. This is not patriotism. Don't get it confused. The owners don't love America more than the players demonstrating and trying to take action to improve it. Okay, there's one perspective. However, the Boston Herald spoke with Matt Light, also former Patriots player, Hall of Fame inductee, and this is what he said. What they did was issue a statement saying we respect our men and women in the armed services, while at the same time giving the players the ability to not respect the men and women in the armed services. To me, according to Matt Light, they outlined a worse scenario before it was never even in the handbook. In league policy, it was never okay not to stand for the national anthem. So if you think about it, they defined the right to not stand. They've literally defined by policy that guys can openly disrespect the men and women in the armed services. So different perspectives here, obviously, from the players themselves. What do you make about that division? Because, of course, we've heard this, that what you're doing by not standing and showing respect for the flag is actually going against the members of our military.
Well, and I'm sure, and I will agree on this, I think the frustrating part is people don't follow the ball. They don't pay attention to the conversation. This was never about a disrespect for our men and women in the armed services. It was never that. And not one athlete I've talked to, not one person of color or a white person who supports the right to take a knee or not stand was ever looking at this as a disrespect to our people in the armed service. This was about a statement about a country that often contradicts itself and, quite frankly, treats its citizens of color with major disrespect in many ways, not just in police action, but in other ways as well. And this was their way of saying, you know what, we won't tolerate that, and we're going to use our celebrity and this opportunity on television to make that statement. For those who think it's a disrespect to our military, you've gotten to the wrong conclusion, and it's unfortunate for a serious conversation.
Or for those who say the NFL is like a private company, right? I mean, their rules, they can do it. Ed, your thoughts about that?
Sure. I think this is about culture. This is about sort of who we are as a country and what we're willing to tolerate, and learning some history. You know, I've been taught by Black friends that the Black protest is never welcomed in America, even in this day, and nobody wants to say that. So I'm not comfortable with everything that Black Lives Matter does, you know, but I look at it and say, boy, I don't want to be that, you know, person, you know, telling my great-grandson and going to a Colin Kaepernick High School the fact that I was on the wrong side of this, you know. So I can't believe how the president puts out this point of view. People fall in line. The conversation is changed, becomes about all these false things. I want to say, you know, they're not mooning the flag. They're not giving the middle finger. They're not turning their back. They're not walking out. They're kneeling. I can't think of the last time I kneeled to show disrespect to something in my life. It's actually the opposite. And it's a shame the fact that people are adopting a language they're hearing out of Washington and from conservative media. This is somehow about, you know, the military. I think that's just completely wrong.
Hmm. And just to add to that, I think the fact that, and I've heard this across the black community when we say this, is the fact that they kneel means they love this country even more because they're challenging it to live up to its ideals. And that actually shows a deeper level of love for this country.
And I expect that we will continue to see this play out in the upcoming season. Yes?
I hope so.
I hope so as well.
So let's end with our hubbubs. Those are the brief stories that caught our attention this week. Maybe didn't make it above the fold. Ed, your hubbub this week.
So last weekend, I took my children to the celebration of the Roxbury Cultural District. We went to the First Roxbury Church and to the bowling center. This is sort of the city and a lot of foundations put a lot of money and effort into trying to promote Roxbury in a time of great change for Boston, especially as Boston is thinking a lot about racism and equality. I think we need Roxbury to succeed mostly on its own terms, and I think we all should take an interest in seeing how that how that's going down there, because if Roxbury fails, the city fails.
All right. Michael.
A little above the fold, but one that I thought was important to mention, which is the hiring of Tito Jackson to run a pot company, Verdant Medical Incorporated. I think back to my years as NAACP president, and I got a call from a black a person who wanted to participate in the dispensary of marijuana and be considered for bids. It was the first round, and he didn't have an opportunity. And it was really about the fact that we can't be left out of this industry. Despite how we feel about marijuana, it's legal now in Massachusetts, and I'm very concerned that there will not be black representation in the wealth that it creates or in the people behind these decisions. And the fact that Tito's taken his job, I think, is a promising side of the story.
All right. Well, my hubbub is a little bit musical, so I want you guys to listen to a little bit of this. Okay, any guesses who that is?
Is that the teenage girl who won some sort of
right,
pop culture
contest? Yeah, good.
I wouldn't have guessed that it was, but I remember I heard the voice before.
Bryn Cartelli from Longmeadow, Massachusetts, who at 15 years old, she became the youngest person to win on NBC's The Voice this week. You know what she gets?
What does she get?
A recording contract and a car that she's not old enough to drive. Yeah, there you go. So Michael Curry, former president of the Boston NAACP and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Also, Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, we get a dose of inspiration from some area commencement speeches. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. As graduation season winds down, we're highlighting some of the speeches from area college and university commencement ceremonies. Earlier this month at UMass Amherst commencement, CNN anchor and chief Washington correspondent Jake Tapper told students to be patient when figuring out what they want to do with their lives.
I didn't become a full-time journalist until I was almost 30. I didn't know what I wanted to do. After film school, I dropped out. I worked on a campaign. I had a whole bunch of odd jobs throughout Washington. I didn't like any of them. I wasn't good at any of them. It's okay to see these next few years, this next decade, as a way to figure out what it is you want to do. You don't have to know today. None of these experiences were a waste of my time. They were my path. They taught me things about myself and about the world. I was in D.C. and I was learning about D.C., seeing it from different vantage points. Now, look, obviously, you're going to have to make a living. And whether that's waiting tables or serving as a paralegal, those choices are yours. You're about to become a freshman at the University of Life, which means you're back to the bottom. And you might have to make copies and you might have to answer phones. And you might feel like you're above that work, but you're not. Let me tell you why. Because those are chances for you to develop something that's not easy to develop, and that's a positive work ethic and attitude. And the quicker you develop that, the quicker that they say you don't have to answer phones anymore.
That's CNN's Jake Tapper speaking at UMass Amherst commencement this month. And last weekend, UNICEF's CEO, Carol Stern, delivered a commencement speech at Babson College.
You are the single largest generation in human history, 80 million strong. You will make up 50% of the workforce by 2020. You will run America for 40 years straight, longer than any other generation. You are the most globally aware generation, seeing the world without borders, and are the most educated, optimistic, and plugged-in generation in human history. You are also the generation that will inherit a $59 trillion wealth transfer from your predecessors. You will dictate how the world, how the digital and consumer worlds reach their constituents. You grew up with things like mandatory service hours as early as kindergarten onwards. You can and you will change the world as we know it today, and change is desperately needed. As I stand here today with you, the world is bearing witness to the largest number of kids on the move since World War II. 50 million children are wandering our planet today. 29 million forcibly removed from their homes, 50 million kids sleeping on rocks instead of on beds, out of school, taking great risks in the hope of finding a more secure and safe future. If we do nothing, we will lose an entire generation.
That was UNICEF CEO Carol Stern speaking at Babson College's commencement ceremony last week. Congratulations to all the 2018 graduates. And stay with us. Coming up, what are you doing this summer? Our guests have some recommendations about enjoying the warm weather outdoors. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, today marks the kickoff to summer in New England, so we want to spend some time talking about how best to enjoy the outdoors these next 14 weeks until Labor Day weekend. Joining us to talk about this is Mel Allen, the editor of Yankee Magazine. He's with us from the studios of NHPR in Concord, New Hampshire. Mel, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here. It's like 86 degrees here in New Hampshire today.
86 in New Hampshire. Happy summer. Also in studio with us is outdoor writer and lecturer at Boston University's College of Communications, Jay Atkinson. Welcome.
My pleasure being here. I'm really looking forward to talking to you and to Mel about this.
And to our listeners, because we're asking them to join the conversation. Listeners, give us some summer recommendations. It is finally warm, according to Mel, 86 degrees in Concord today. So what are you doing for the summer? Are you planning to go to the White Mountains or the beach? Do you have a secret spot that you want to share? You can call us and share some of those summer favorites at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Mel, I want to start with you. Give us your top two, if you have them, personal favorite outdoor spots to visit in the summer.
Well, top two out of everything in New England.
Just start
That's
with
great.
Two.
Okay, so should we start right close to Boston, let's say, okay?
Okay.
And what I usually do when I go somewhere for when we do our travel stories, I ask people, if you had a long-lost friend who's visiting you for a weekend, what would you like to do with them? So that's how I'm going to treat our audience.
Okay.
You're my friends. You're coming to New England just for the weekend. And I would say, you're probably going to want to go to the Cape, and it's summer. And I'm going to say, well, do you want to bring a book or a foreign language tape and listen to it in the car for 6 hours while you're clogged in traffic? Or we could do something else, and we could take a ferry. And I would probably get aboard the ferry on Long Wharf. It's a 90-minute cruise to Provincetown. When you get off, it's one of the best walking towns in New England. You know, everything is right there. They have different trips all day, all weekend, all during the week in the summer. You bring your bike for about $8. You ride through the province lands, get out to the dunes, come back that night. That's one of them.
That's a day trip. That's just a day trip, yeah.
That's a great day trip. Or you can just go to where so many Bostonians have never been here. It's the Boston Harbor Islands National Recreation Area. It's surprising how many locals have not been to the islands. They've never set foot on them. But at the same time, you're tied to the city, yet you're seeing it from a whole different perspective. There are 34 islands. You get six of them. They're reachable by ferry from the Long Wharf. Some of them have campgrounds. These are primitive campgrounds. One of them, Pettix Island, even has these little yurts. Those are two really top places that you just grow right from the city.
So you gave us, you know, you're in New Hampshire, but you gave us two very Boston-centric recommendations.
Well, I was actually told tell people from Boston, but if you want, if I can go out, I can give you some great places outside of Boston. Let me tell you.
Okay. we'll get to those. Jay Atkinson, your top two New England summer destinations.
So I'll just give you a couple that I've done lately. We're in the middle of the summer season for outdoor adventure already. So one of my favorite rituals of summer is meet a couple friends of mine, which we did last Friday, at Walden Pond just before sunrise and swim across Walden Pond and come back. Mm. And then everybody, we have 10, 15 minutes to talk, catch up, and then everybody disperses to work from there. So that's a quickie.
Nice. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a great one. And on the more extreme level, the more difficult level, the more distant story that I wrote for New Hampshire Magazine that just ran, we went up to Errol, New Hampshire, which is 75 miles north of Mount Washington. It's in Coos County. There's something there called the Dartmouth Land Grant, which is owned by Dartmouth College. Thousands of acres, restricted to day travel only, unless you have an affiliation with Dartmouth, which is kind of interesting and odd.
Really?
You can stay in some of the cabins on the land if you have an affiliation with Dartmouth. Huh. So we went up there and we mountain biked in from the parking lot about 12 miles on the Dead Diamond River. And then we went fly fishing, and it's the best native trout fly fishing in New Hampshire I've ever seen. It was a family thing. I went with one of my rugby friends, his 10-year-old son. So the mountain biking was okay for kids.
Say the name of it again?
The name of it is, it's the second land grant belonging to Dartmouth College. It's 20 minutes north of Errol, New Hampshire on Route 16. And then we camped at the Mollage Walk campground practically right outside the gates of the park, which is a state park.
So would you call it one of your undiscovered sort of places? I know nobody wants to talk about undiscovered places because then, of course, they might not remain undiscovered. But would you say that's sort of an undiscovered treasure in New England, a place to go? Yeah.
We were there two full days because you had to leave at night to go camp at Mollage Walk. We saw three people.
Nice.
All the time we were there.
Nice.
And
I'm going to just add that where Jay was is also right near Lake Umbagog, which is one of the most pristine wild lakes in New England. You're going to see bald eagles. You're going to see loons, and they have some primitive camping there as well. It's just one of those wild lakes where you feel you have left civilization behind.
It's right funny you say that, Mel, because that was my next one. We're going there next month.
Really, really. Yeah. So Mel, do you have an undiscovered treasure for us? You're willing to share?
Undiscovered treasures. Every issue, Deborah, we do something called Could You Live Here, which is we take the idea of where would people like to go, and when they're there, they think, I really like this, and could you live here? And within those places, we try to find what people might find surprising. And we just came back from Bristol, Rhode Island, and Bristol, Rhode Island, it's one of those places, if you've been there, you know it. But if you've never been there, you'll be really surprised by how much this town of 20,000 has. I think it's one of the great bicycling areas in New England. They have a 14-mile bike path called the East Bay Bike Path. And a lot of it goes right along the shores of Narragansett Bay. You can ride from Bristol to Providence. Mm-hmm. But the real gem here is Colt State Park, because there are these bike trails that wind all through this state park. It's over 400 acres right on the bay. You can pack a lunch. You have this great picnic. It used to be owned by Samuel Colt. It's really beautiful. And the bike trails connect to the East Bay Bike Path, so you can literally spend hours bicycling. You come into the town. It's a sailing capital because this is where the Herrschaffs built the great sailing boats that used to win the America's Cup. You'll see boats in the bay, and it's for a town of its size. It has eateries, I think the equivalent of towns much, much bigger.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for those recommendations. We've got some good ones here. Listeners, what are yours? What are you doing this summer? You're going to the mountains, going to the beach, you're going to the lake. Share some of your warm weather recommendations with us by calling 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Andrew is on the line. He's calling from Danvers. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Where should we go in the summer, Andrew?
I wanted to point out actually, it's a discoverable treasure. It's a third-generation experience over to Castle Island in Boston. My father's father has taken him there. My father has taken me there. Now I'm taking my three-year-old son there almost every weekend since the weather had changed and Mother Nature's working in our favor.
And so what do you like about it?
Oh, I love walking around just the island itself. You know, my son enjoys the beachfront, watching the planes from Logan Airport. The seaport is right there. You know, you see the boats being loaded with the cranes. It's really, if you're from out of town, it's something you have to do. And Sullivan's the iconic landmark there.
Sullivan's, right. Okay, well, Andrew, thanks so much for the recommendation. I want to go now to Jim, who is calling from Worcester. Jim, what do you recommend we do in this summer?
Ice cream and swimming.
Right.
Probably both at the same time.
Any specifics?
Well, not really. I mean, I'm actually grew up in Concord, New Hampshire, where you're one of your guests is from. And but you can't go wrong with a friendly fribble.
Friendly fribble and perhaps Walden Pond, maybe. I mean,
sure.
Beach, lake, doesn't matter.
The beach, lake, pool,
anywhere.
Your sprinkler.
All right. Jim, thanks so much for the call. We talked a little bit about the Harbor Islands. I know we mentioned that, and that's part of the National Park System. We've got the big one, right, Acadia in Maine. I think 3.5 million visitors every year. But many people probably don't know that the Harbor Islands are a national park, but Beth Jackendoff does. She's a park ranger for the National Park Service, and she is on the line to tell us a little bit about what's happening at the Harbor Islands this summer. Beth, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Deborah, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, tell us, first off, best way to get to the islands. And you know, I know Mel had mentioned the Harbor Islands and said there are many islands, but you can get there by ferry, right?
Yeah, of course. So actually, starting this weekend, on Saturday, we kick off the 2018 season with our free ferry day to Spectacle and George's Island. And then we'll have ferry 7 days a week through October 8th out to the islands.
Okay, and you can camp as well?
Yeah, you can. You can camp. Starting June 22nd, you'll have access to six of our different islands that we have. Four of them are camping islands that you can actually camp on. We still have spots available. But those camping islands are great for people who may just want to be off the beaten path for a day trip. We'll also be having three night sky programs on Petticks Island, and you can find out more about that on our website, bostonharborislands.org.
How long of a ferry trip is it typically there and back, on average?
Sure. Spectacle Island is about a 30-minute ferry ride, and it makes you feel like you're miles away. George's Island, which is our most popular island, the home of Fort Warren, is about a 45-minute ferry ride from Long Wharf North. And there's also access from Hingham on our south shore.
So tell us, I know that these islands have a rich history. Give us a quick story about a famous island legend.
Oh, the Lady in Black.
Okay.
We have people coming from all over the world looking for the Lady in Black out at George's Island in Fort Warren. And so sometimes people bring their flashlights to look for her in the dark hallways and dark tunnels of George's Island. And legend has it she can be seen walking the ramparts of the fort at night.
Well, who's she supposed to be?
It's a legend. Okay. of a woman that lost her husband out on George's Island.
Huh. And some people report seeing this woman dressed in black walking around the island.
Yeah, yep.
Okay.
You can come look for her if you'd like.
All right, Beth Jackendoff, Park Ranger. I think I'll enjoy the water. Park Ranger for the National Park Service. thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. See you out on the island.
Okay. Jay Atkinson, I'm wondering if people are sort of in the city and just want to do a quick day trip to enjoy the weather, maybe play hooky for the day, I don't know. What's your recommendation?
From Boston, from downtown? Yeah. I mean, the Minuteman bike trail through Lexington, Concord, and then, you know, you can be in the woods, but then you can go have lunch somewhere. Me, I like mountain biking and trail running, and the Bay Circuit Trail runs all the way up to the New Hampshire border and comes close to the city. So I usually run on out of Andover, Massachusetts, but you can get on the Bay Circuit Trail at lots of different places. You see hikers, you see mountain bikers. This time of year, you would want to spray yourself for ticks if you're a runner or a biker,
right?
And wear long sleeves.
Right.
So that's another one.
Yeah. And Mel, you know, you had suggested visiting traditional college towns in New England in the summer. Why is that?
Because this is like one of those little surprises, because all the kids, all the students are away. But a college town, almost by definition, has great shops, has great great restaurants. And in New England, for example, Northampton has the Norwalk Rail Trail. It's like 10 miles long. It links three different college towns, Northampton, Amherst, and Hadley. And then when you're in Hadley, what do you have? You have Mount Holyoke College. It's often been called the most beautiful campus in America. And right there is Skinner State Park and Mount Tom. You know why that's so cool? You can drive up to the summit, or you can hike up to the summit. And when you get there, it's like the epicenter of the hang gliding culture in New England. I used to take my kids there, and you'd sit there on the bluff, let's say, and all these hang gliders are going by you like these Superman hawks, and the kids are going to be mesmerized. And very few people actually know about that.
Very nice. So that's another. We're getting some really good undiscovered recommendations here. We've got Bristol, Rhode Island, college towns, a couple of state parks, the Harbor Islands. We want to hear from our listeners as well. Undiscovered or well discovered favorite summer places. Joseph is calling from Linfield. Joseph, you're on the air.
Yes.
So where are you going this summer?
For taking my call. All right. So North Shore. So my favorite is Crane Beach. And then on top of that, Good Harbor Beach, which is also a favorite. And then, of course, there's Wingersheet.
In Gloucester.
Of course, Crane is my favorite. Yeah.
In Gloucester.
Crane's my favorite because you've got the estate up there, and they got a little winery and some stuff in the area that you know, for very little money or no money, you can really do some fun things.
But Joseph, you have to tell people though why you don't want to go there in July. You have to be fair. Why do you not want to go to Crane's Beach in July? It's the greenhead flies,
all
right?
It's all about timing, though, right? If you go late in the day, you know, there's no one.
But what about the flies? Mel is talking about the flies on Crane's Beach.
Well, again, I have not encountered it to be bad for me, but you know, I understand what you're saying. Sometimes the kids complain about that. But you know what? Try it. You'll never regret it.
All right, Joe, thanks. Thanks so much for the call. So we've got some beach recommendations there. I also want to go to Linda, who is calling from Lexington, but she has not an out of Boston recommendation. Linda, where are you going this summer? What do you recommend?
Well, mine is not so much kid friendly. It could be kid friendly, but whenever we have guests in from out of town, we love to take them over to East Boston. Because you get the most incredible views of the Boston skyline, especially if you do it right at dusk. So Pier Park is over there. The Down East Cider Brewery is over there. They have tours. We like to hang out at the Real House, which is a restaurant, and they've got expansive outdoor seating, and we just love to spend our evenings there. You can even just take a water taxi up to their dock.
Okay, well, Linda, thanks so much for the call. I want to go outside of the city now, because I feel like we've talked a lot about city things. What about camping and sort of really getting into the outdoors? Mel, Jay, I know you mentioned some camping in New Hampshire, but Mel, you first. A good camping area that you recommend to folks, and where you don't have to be, you know, someone who can really sort of rough it for a while.
I'd like to give you two. I might sneak in a third really quick.
Okay.
The first one, because everyone loves the White Mountains, and you're right there in the White Mountain National Forest, it's the Lafayette Place Campground. It's right in the center of Franconia State Park, and it was one of our this year 2018 Best of New England picks, which is out on the newsstand now. And it's only, you get there in no time at all on 93, and you're right in the heart of the White Mountains. The second one is, of course, my favorite. It's Baxter State Park. Yes, it's a haul from Boston. It's about 5 hours, but it's the, I think it's the most grandest state park east of the Mississippi by far. Hmm. It was 200,000 acres that was given to the state by one man, Percival Baxter. It's called his Grand Obsession. It's where Katahdin rises over everything. Chimney Pond is an alpine lake that you hike into. You will feel like you are in the middle of your own universe when you're there. And finally, because you mentioned how 3 million people go to Acadia mm-hmm. National Park, if you just keep driving, go past Acadia, you're going to come to Cobbs Cook Bay State Park, which we called in Yankee the most beautiful camping in New England. And you're right. And it's just gorgeous.
Wow. Great recommendation. We only have 14 weeks, so I don't think we can get all those in. Jay Atkinson, camping recommendation?
It's funny, listening to Mel a few minutes ago mention Lake Umbagog up in northern mm-hmm. New Hampshire. You have to remember, wilderness enthusiasts, just like fishermen and surfers, have secret spots that they don't want anyone to know about. And I wasn't going to mention this, but Mel already threw it out there. So one of the adventures that we have planned for this summer that I'll be writing about for New Hampshire Magazine is some of us will paddle and some of us will swim, open water swim, from the boat launch on Lake Umbagog to these remote campsites on an island. Huh. So some of us are going to have our stuff ferried out, like our tents and our sleeping bags and all that, by canoe. And the rest of us are going to put on our wetsuits and swim out there, spend the night on the island, have dinner there. It's a family thing. There'll be probably about five or six of my rugby friends and their families. And then the next morning, swim back.
Wow.
So there's not going to be anyone out there. There's only a few sites per island.
Right.
So I'm really looking forward to that one.
So I think Jay should have his own segment called the Survivor Summer.
Well, I do want to talk about hiking, too, because there's a lot of beautiful hiking. And for many people, serious hiking, too. That means typically the Appalachian Trail, right? And this was supposed to be the trail connecting the two highest mountains in the eastern U.S., Mount Washington in New Hampshire, Mount Mitchell in Georgia. And John Judge is CEO of the Appalachia Mountain Club. He is on the line right now. John, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, do you have to be a serious hiker to hike the trail, at least this part of it in New England?
Well, you know, you've got so many options in here, and listening to your guests, it just shows you in New England how fortunate we are to have all of these options around us. You know, the Beatty Circuit Trail, which was mentioned earlier, which is an Appalachian Mountain Club maintained and stewarded trail that runs from Plum Island out to Framingham down to Duxbury. It's a 230-mile trail that's close to, you know, millions of people in the Boston area. You could go out to the Berkshires and stay at one of our campsites out there. Dozens of opportunities in New Hampshire, of course, hiking up to the huts, the AMC huts in the White Mountains, which is the oldest hut system in America. The first one was built in 1888. So you really have everything from soft adventures, you know, easy kind of day hikes close to home in the Blue Hills or in the Middlesex Fells, you know, close to Boston. Mm. Things in southern New Hampshire like Welch Dickey or Mount Monadnock. But we're so lucky, you know, to have all the variety and the skill levels around New England.
So you can do walks as well as hikes, essentially.
Sure, okay. Yeah, absolutely. I just a quick aside. I blew out my Achilles a couple months ago, so I'm getting back into it. And the Bay Circuit Trail is just the perfect place to do it. There are some ups and downs, but if you're a novice and you want to get into hiking, it's a great way to do it before you strap on a 30-pound pack and go up to our huts in the White Mountains or any of our lodges in the Maine wilderness area.
But in terms of the Appalachian Trail, it's about 2,200 miles long, and describe it a little bit and tell us about the huts just briefly.
Sure. So we're the Appalachian Mountain Club, so we're quite a bit older than the founding of the Appalachian Trail, which Benton McKay, among others.
We have about 20 seconds, John, so we have to be very quick. Yeah.
Oh, sure. So the high mountain huts are up in the New Hampshire section of the Appalachian Trail, so you can hike up there and have a nice dinner, stay overnight with us, and then have breakfast in the morning, go through an astronomy program or a naturalist program. But it's really one of those bucket list kind of trips for families or for friends to head up and enjoy the outdoors in New England.
Okay. John Judge, CEO of the Appalachian Mountain Club, joined us today, as did Mel Allen, the editor of Yankee Magazine, and Jay Atkinson, outdoor writer and lecturer at Boston University's College of Communications. I want to thank all of you. We're ending the show today with an Appalachian Trail Symphony, New England, by composer and pianist Keene Southard. This part of the symphony depicts when Southard arrived at Mount Katahdin, and this recording is from an April performance of the symphony in Massachusetts. That's it for this week. Stay with us and join us next week. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.